everyone. Thank you for joining us for today's webinar. It's entitled, Girls Under the Umbrella of Autism Spectrum Disorders, Practical Solutions for Addressing Everyday Challenges with Dr. Lori Ernstberger. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernatitis. I have a 13-year-old son with autism and have been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at the age of 4. I've served as president of the Autism Society of America Dayton chapter. I've worked as the assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, and I'm a regular contributor to Autism Today. There are two ways to participate in today's webinar. You can log in to momsfightingautism.com. The webinar is completely free. Once you're registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of your screen. There you can click Listen In and hear the discussion via the Internet. You can click Ask a Question if you'd like to submit a question for our speaker. And you can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806 and enter conference ID number 168978#. All callers are immediately muted, so don't worry about background noises. We can't hear you. Later in our webinar, I'll let you know how you can ask a question directly to our presenter if you wish. We will try to get to as many of the questions and topics as we can in the time that we have allotted. When the slideshow begins, Internet users can go to their blue box and click Slides to view the slideshow. It just takes about 16 seconds to connect, so don't worry, it will. Once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides to either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. If you're listening by phone, be sure to mute your computer so you don't get an echo. And without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Lori Ernstberger. She is from Henderson, Nevada, where she is the owner of Autism and Behavioral Consulting. Dr. Lori received her doctorate in special education from the Indiana University. She has over 25 years of experience working in the public schools as a classroom teacher, administrator, and behavioral consultant. She's also an adjunct professor at St. Petersburg College in Florida. Dr. Ernstberger currently provides staff development and conference workshops to school district personnel and parents. Her workshops cover the following topics: managing problem behaviors, implementing effective instructional methods, designing appropriate and functional data collection methods for the classroom, practical strategies for working with individuals with Asperger syndrome, and how to get your kids to eat. Dr. Ernstberger is the author of Keys to Success for Teaching Students with Autism and Just Take a Bite, Easy, Effective Answers to Food Aversions and Eating Challenges, and Girls Under the Umbrella of Autism Spectrum Disorders. Welcome, Dr. Ernstberger.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I'm glad to be talking to all of you today. Your first screen here, you see this beautiful painting, and I am going to come back because this is significant to the topic that we're talking about today. So if you want to just take a second, it's a great work of art, and I'm going to talk about its artist as we get to today's topic. First of all, just a quick overview of what I'm hoping to cover in the next hour or so. We did a little bit of introduction of my past work, but I want to talk specifically today about the gender differences and characteristics of girls with autism or Asperger syndrome. We're going to look at some of the issues that might pop up during the school age years in the area of social skills. Might touch a little bit on bullying and the puberty issues that are going on with some of our girls on the spectrum. And then we're going to end today's session with looking at advocacy and self-determination. What are our long-term goals for our girls? Well, Nancy did a fine job of the introduction, so I don't think I have to go back and review any of that to let you know that if you have any questions after you listen to today's topic and you might want to follow up with a question, you can always email me at drlori@cox.net. That's the best way of getting a hold of me after today's session. So let's jump into what are we going to be focusing on today. And here is my good friend, Madison Wendell. I'm going to be talking about Maddie throughout today. And she was one of our inspirations for the book, Girls Under the Umbrella. Maddie is the daughter of my co-author, Danielle Wendell, and Maddie was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome at the age of 5. Danielle, several years ago, got together with me and decided we need to look at why are there so few girls out there on the spectrum? What is happening in the field? We talk a lot about boys, and everything is in the pronoun he, but where are our girls represented? So here's Madison. I'm going to weave her story into today's session so you'll learn more about Maddie as we go along, or Madison, as she likes to be called now that she's 16. First, let me give you a couple of statistics. 4 to 1, you may hear that quite a bit out in the field, and that is boys to girls. But that is for autism only. That is as we look at the CDC, Center for Disease and Control and Prevention, or the Autism Society of America statistics, we look at 4 to 1 for autism. But what's even more startling is that 10 to 1 for Asperger syndrome. That means for every 10 boys, only one girl is being identified and diagnosed with Asperger syndrome. And I have to go back in time. I think it's significant to look at the research and the seminal piece of research that started us looking at this field, and that, of course, is Hans Asperger. If you've had an opportunity to read his original research, which I encourage you to do that, he was a very insightful physician. But if you read closely, he has a quote that I'm using here. He says that girls just don't have autism. He said they're better learners, they're more gifted, as you can see. It may be that there are just no autistic girls. We just don't know. And I think that put us on a path, and us in the field of education and in the medical field, of really looking at males on the spectrum. If you know Hans Asperger's work, he did case studies of 5 boys. He called them his little professors. And in those early works, we looked at only the male-dominated characteristics. So this starts many years ago, and I think it leads us to a belief or a foundation of this 4 to 1 and 10 to 1. So let's continue on. I love Ami Klin. This is a professor from Yale University. Ami Klin has identified some girls on the spectrum, but he calls them research orphans. And I think that's an apropos term, because when you read the research and you look at who are we studying, we tend to be studying males. If an organization like the UCLA Mind Institute or Yale University or Princeton, some of these larger autism centers, if they do research, if they've got 100 people in their research and only 2 of them are girls, they're going to actually remove those from their studies because they don't represent the population. And so they are research orphans. He goes on to talk about that girls being underdiagnosed, and I think that's the theme of today's session, is we are underdiagnosing women and girls on the spectrum. And when we do that, when we're not providing early intervention, when we're not providing those educational supports, modifications, and accommodations throughout the school age years and beyond, then we get more lower outcomes, poor outcomes for our girls and our women. And so we want to make sure that our goal today is to give girls a voice. We want to support that girls and women on the spectrum have a unique set of characteristics that we may not be looking at on the research when we provide a diagnosis or when a psychologist is doing assessment tools, or even school psychologists doing a multidisciplinary assessment. I think that as with all areas of autism and Asperger syndrome, we continuously hear early intervention. This comes out of educating children with autism, the National Autism Center, Autism Society of America. You read these national organizations reminding us the importance of early intervention. And in order to do that, that means earlier diagnosis. So when we looked at what are some of the first signs out there for girls on the spectrum, one of them is they have better social imitation skills. And this is where I'm going to refer to you to one of my colleagues in the field, and she wrote the foreword for our book, Girls Under the Umbrella, and that's Leanne Holiday Willey. If you've never had an opportunity to visit Leanne's website or read her book, Pretending to Be Normal, I encourage you to do so. She has a unique perspective from a women's perspective. But what she talks about throughout the book and continues to talk about today is that she always was acting, meaning she was imitating the people around her. And so although she clearly had the characteristics for Asperger syndrome early on, she was able to mask a lot of that because she pretended to be normal. And she said to this day she struggles with going out into a social environment. She can easily take on the mannerisms. She can easily take on even dialects and colloquialisms of the people in that setting. And so we have to be careful that when we look at imitation skills for a child, that we're really looking at imitation skills that child is doing across settings and not just imitating their peers. Other things that first signs, they do continue to have odd or restricted play skills that may be similar, though, to other girls their same age. For example, Maddie, when she was very young, 3 and 4, 5 years of age, she did play with dolls. Danielle said, I remember specifically buying her dolls. She played with her dolls. But on further retrospect and observation, it was still restricted play. It was she was lining up her baby still. She was the way they had to lay in the bed. The blanket had to be over their faces in a certain way. So it was still the restrictedness, but to maybe an outsider or a layman or even the doctor questioning Danielle, again, my co-author with my book, she would say, yeah, she plays with dolls. And that may seem age-appropriate and typical, but it was still an odd play skill. It was still restrictive. We also know in general, look at the research, girl development versus boy development, males versus females in those early years, genetically, by the way we are nurtured in our environment, girls are more passive and lack an initiative. We tend to be, women, girls, young girls, tend to be non-aggressive. And because of that, it's the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So for the 4-year-old boy who is throwing his toys and hitting his schoolmate, that's going to get a lot of attention. A girl that's more passive, that's not initiating, is going to be overlooked. For example, the daydreaming might be occurring. Girls, though, we do see early signs of that anxiety and excessive worrying. So I think it's important that we go beyond just what we might quickly view or observe behaviors, because again, girls being different from boys in typical development, we need to go back and say, is that pretend play or is that a restrictive, repetitive, more stereotypical type of play skill? Now, I'm going to quote some of the girls and women we've been able to meet, Danielle and I, over the years. So many fascinating women out there who have stories to tell. This is actually from a parent. Karen is a parent of a girl that we interviewed, Rosemary. But this is Karen as a mother saying, I knew something was different. She just couldn't put her finger on it for Rosemary. You know, she would draw, which maybe that would seem age-appropriate, might seem typical for a girl to do at a certain age. But she said there were still those behaviors that were different from her other boys. And I want to share this next picture with you, which is Rosemary and her brother, very close family. And we even got a chance to interview her brother because he had so many great stories to tell that we share in the book about what's it like being an older brother or any sibling when your sister is on the spectrum. And so Rosemary was not diagnosed till much later, even though her mom said over and over again, she talked to the doctor, the pediatrician, she talked to the school, But nobody put all the pieces together, unfortunately, until she was much older. So the gender differences are there. I think it's important to know that girls are not going to fit the male prototype for Asperger syndrome or autism spectrum disorders, we might say. And here is another research article saying that girls aren't fascinated with numbers, which is something that we all often relate to for somebody on the spectrum. Or they don't often have stores of arcane knowledge. So they don't fit that male prototype, so oftentimes they're overlooked. And the next person I'm quoting here is Jean Kearns Miller, who was the editor for a book, Women from Another Planet. And she talks about, here again, that males are aggressive. They act out, and therefore the doctor says, oh, yes, there's a problem. Or the school psychologist says, oh, I can see that in the classroom. Yes, there must be some kind of a educational eligibility for special services. And she says, but whereas if a girl is compliant or quiet, they get overlooked and underdiagnosed, but clearly there are gaps in their skills, gaps in their learning, gaps in their social behaviors, communication behaviors, but they're overlooked. Other gender differences that we were able to find in the research, and again, there's not much out there in the research on girls because, as Amit Klin said, girls are research orphans, and so if you look up girls and autism, you're not going to see much, but we do have a little bit from Kopp and Gilbert talking again about, as psychologists, psychiatrists, educators, we rely on the male prototype. What does a male with autism look like? And then we tend to compare girls to that stereotype, to that prototype, and the girls don't meet those behaviors or those characteristics, and so they're not getting that early identification. Again, males, what does that mean? Externalized behaviors, meaning you can see it from the outside. Girls internalize the anxiety, the shyness, the quietness, the withdrawn. Those are internalized behaviors. And so Zosia Zaks is a woman on the spectrum. And so if girls are sensitive, then people say, well, she's certainly not on the spectrum. Or if a girl has empathy or makes eye contact, then that is their way of being reinforced. And so we know that reinforcement is very powerful to change behavior. And so if a girl is continuously reinforced from the environment, the adults around her every day, for being nice, for being empathetic, for being quiet, for sitting quietly, then of course that behavior is going to repeat itself because it's being reinforced. And so she learned that from an early age, that the quieter she was, the more compliant she was, the more reinforcement she received, and was not then therefore diagnosed with Asperger syndrome until much later. Now here we can go back and look at some earlier research, 2003, from Simon Baron Cohen. Simon Baron Cohen is a Cambridge University professor, and he wrote a book called The Essential Difference. Now, he wasn't just looking at girls or why are we underdiagnosing girls 4-to-1, 10-to-1. What Simon Baron Cohen was looking at was really how are we diagnosing males with autism or Asperger syndrome, and he came up with two specific categories in terms of how we look at people, females versus males, females being what he calls the empathizers, the word empathy or nurturers, and so I've listed here how he differentiates empathizers, comforting, sensitive to emotions, more focused on the relationship, more collaborative, increased communication skills. And so we think of those characteristics. Those are our female characteristics. Those are our empathizers. And then we have our systemizers. And who are those? They are more driven by numbers. They're more technical thinking, linear thinking, more mechanical. They tend to be more aggressive. They're more based on empirical evidence, or they want to see the numbers involved. Give me the percentage or the median or the mean. they're interested in organizing and classifying information. So they tend to be more finite systems or closed systems. They are rule-bound and set by structure. So Simon Baron-Cohen says, well, we can categorize all of us into these two groups. More of the female is going to be on our empathizers. More of our males, and he has assessment tools, are going to be systemizers. And then what he goes on to project from this information, and that's what our next graph is describing, up in your, as you face your screen, up in the left-hand quadrant is where our empathizer score. And so that's where you're going to see most females when you take his autism essential quotient, so just a little behavioral checklist. When you look at his assessment tool, most females will score in that upper left-hand corner as your empathizers. And then he said most males, as he has used this assessment tool, are going to score in your bottom right-hand corner. So all the way down to the bottom in that darkest black area is where he is referring to your extreme male brain or the extreme systemizers. So he's saying that's where autism lies. He is theorizing that autism lies in that lower right-hand corner, in that darkest black area, that most people on the autism spectrum are going to fall when they take his assessment tool in that right-hand corner. Well, here's where I want to put an overlay of girls on the spectrum or women on the spectrum. Already, girls are going to genetically and based on the environment score up in that left-hand corner. If you are now a girl with autism or Asperger syndrome, it would be nearly impossible to score down in that darker right-hand corner, because you start out as a female brain. The female brain is naturally an empathizer. Our hormones are different. Our brains are different. Our genetics are, so all the physiology of being a female is in that left-hand quadrant. And so in order for a girl to score high enough to even get to be in that systemizing quadrant, you would have to have extreme behaviors in order to be in that area. And so I think although Simon Baron-Cohen was not making a case for girls, I think he does help us understand why do we see that 4-to-1 and 10-to-1, because when we overlay women and girls in terms of their characteristics and behaviors, it is not going to come out the same as an overlay of male brain or male characteristics who are already starting out in that right-hand quadrant. They already begin in that lower corner. So it doesn't take many behaviors for them to qualify. So unfortunately, again, there is a delay. Women are being diagnosed much later. And we are seeing such a gap in services for males versus females on the autism spectrum. So if you look at his work, I encourage you to do so. Look at how would my child, if I've got a daughter, how would she score? If you looked at the book, The Essential Difference, or if you look at his assessment tool, if you already start out in that left-hand quadrant, how could you possibly qualify as a diagnosis? And as you know, this is a here in the United States, under the DSM or under IDEA, you must qualify for services or qualify for a diagnosis, and that's usually a test score. And our girls may not be receiving the appropriate assessment test scores based on this female brain versus male brain. And so Simon Baron-Cohen goes on to say, we shouldn't assume that they're going to look the same. And I know that almost sounds like common sense. You know, if you asked anybody who has a male child or a female child, you ask any classroom teacher, boys versus girls, they will tell you, right, just kind of common sense. Boys are different from girls. Are there a lot of similarities? Of course. But just in terms of gender and the physiology, there is a difference. And so as a psychologist or a school psychologist, to look at that female and say, they're all the same, is really setting up females for a much more challenging road in terms of diagnosis. And so those male patterns of systemizing have to be exaggerated to the extreme in order for a female to be diagnosed with ASD. So review that work. I think it's something for all of us to think about. If you have a child or a daughter on the spectrum who is not qualified, I think it's important that we ask ourselves, is it because we have set up all our assessment tools as being what I consider gender neutral? But gender is not neutral. Gender is very specific for each of us. And so we need to make sure that we are not considering all girls and all boys the same. Going back, here's another great picture of Maddie throughout the years. You'll get to know her, Madison Wendell. And again, Jean Kearns Miller, the editor of Women from Another Planet. And she talks about that because of the underdiagnosing of women with ASD, females are being marginalized. They're not getting early intervention. Therefore, they stay in the background the rest of their lives, and they tend to be isolated. And the quality of life for women that are not receiving services is the outcomes are much more poor. There's Maddie again. So what are our take-home messages? What can we bring back to our pediatricians, our psychologists, our school assessment teams? I think, first of all, we need to start asking the questions. Are you using a male-centered profile or assessment? Are you looking at the different symptoms or characteristics between boys and girls? Are we comparing our girl on the spectrum with other boys? Or are we comparing them to a neurotypical girl? And I think there are a few of us here that in the field of autism that have focused on girls and women. And what we have said over and over again is we would like to see school multidisciplinary teams. We would like to see psychologists in the field, psychiatrists, say, I'm going to compare this girl not to other boys on the spectrum, but to a neurotypical girl. What is typical girl behavior at this age, and is this child within that range of appropriate behaviors or adaptive behaviors? And so we need to ensure as parents, are we using assessment tools that have the ability to detect the more subtle characteristics that we might be seeing in our females? How severe does a girl need to be in order to be diagnosed? Should we have sex-specific norms or cutoff scores for our girls on the spectrum? And if you look at the ADD-ADHD community, that is something that has been well-researched, that girls with ADD and ADHD oftentimes will have different characteristics, a different profile. And that field, the medical field and educational field, is considering specific cutoff scores, different males versus females for ADD and ADHD. And I think what I'm theorizing here and suggesting for you all to think about is, well, maybe we should be doing the same for kids on the spectrum, for girls versus boys on the spectrum. Should we have a different cutoff score so we don't see that 10-to-1 ratio boys to girls? And so I think it's important also that, and this is for any child on the spectrum, that we continue to reevaluate as necessary. And so that in case some of these symptoms that we may not be seeing early on, that as we reach puberty can be exasperated. And so parents, maybe you, as Karen's mom, or as Rosemary's mom did, Karen, she did take Rosemary to the doctor repeatedly, but once Rosemary hit puberty, that was when the hormones kicked in and she did become more aggressive. She did become, the anxiety kicked in, not wanting to go to school. And so we need to continually reevaluate because those symptoms might manifest themselves in later years. as I said, we want to make sure we're comparing girls with other girls as we make our assessment tools. We want to make sure also as we look at the family, so important, many of the families that we interviewed for our book on girls said, you know, my daughter in preschool or in second grade or in fifth grade does pretty well in school. Again, they tend to be the more passive child in the classroom, the daydreamer, more compliant, doesn't have many friends or any friends, but really the more quiet child in the classroom. But then if you talk to the family, and that's where family interviews are so important, that for example, on the ADIR, that family interview is so important because the families can say, we are seeing very different behaviors at home. Because when the child feels more comfortable in the home setting, we may be seeing some of those more extreme autism behaviors in terms of the communication, social, and restricted behaviors. So instead of just saying there's a cutoff score on the ADOS or on the CARS or on the GADS or whatever autism assessment tool you're using, where are we really taking into consideration what families are saying? And Danielle said for many times she would bring Maddie to the psychologist, and the psychologist said, oh, she seems to be doing fine. Maddie would come in, you're only in there for 5 minutes, and she would get along, she'd smile, she seemed like a very compliant child. But Danielle said at home it was a completely different child. Or taking her out in the community, she would see more of the extreme behaviors. And it took a long time for the psychologist to really be swayed in that area. So it's important that families and the family interview process is heavily considered when we look at girls and women on the spectrum. And then again, I mentioned here separate cutoffs. And I think that is a legitimate question to ask your multidisciplinary team. What is the cutoff score? What is the range? And is that a range for males, or is it a range for males and females? Looking at gender in a very neutral way, even though gender is not neutral. Girls are different than boys. So hopefully that information on assessment, the diagnosis, the gender differences has got you thinking in a different way. In terms of what are we doing here in the U.S., and not just in the U.S., I present all over the world, Canada, are we using a male prototype to identify our girls? All right, let's move on to the next section of our today's topic. And that is we're going to look at some different areas then where we might be doing some training for our girls and the area of social communication. Got to talk just a little bit about bullying in girls, although that's a hot topic right now in the field of education in general. Now, social skills, much talked about. Many of us have read great social skills books out there. If you are looking for a social skills book for your child, feel free to email me at drlori@cox.net. I can easily name 5 or 6 books that have come out in the last 5 years or so, even a little bit longer than that, that are excellent books. Jed Baker is one that I'm always interested in sharing his information with families. But what needs to be said when it comes to females, though, is we need to make sure that when we're teaching social skills, we don't treat social skills or communication skills as gender neutral. Just like with the diagnosis, social skills are very different, males versus females. Females socialize very different. So no matter what kind of social skills book or research or reference you're using, you want to make sure, whether you're the parent or the professional, that you are looking at that social skills book and saying, what part of this is for females? What part of these social skills is important for females to be more, have a quality of life in terms of at school and at home? So social skills, of course, it needs to be part of our everyday training at home and at school. It is the key to success for any outcome. If you're going to get along, if you're going to have a job, if you're going to be out in the community, you have to have those basic social skills. but I want us to look at social skills very much specific to the gender that we're teaching it to. Social skills are not gender neutral. And here's another quote by Rosemary. I mentioned her earlier, and you're going to see a picture of her. I won't read the quote to you. I like to have quotes because I think it's so important that we hear from our females and our women in the field, like Zosia and Rosemary and Leanne Holiday-Willie, because they are the experts here. They are living this every day. So Rosemary shares her concerns that she's had in class, particularly being very attached to specific schoolmates. So when we look at social skills, when you look at whatever social skills curriculum you might be using, whether it's Jed Baker, Jeannie McAfee, Scott Bellini, there's certainly a variety of great social skills books out there for parents and professionals. I want you to look at those skills that they're teaching and say, is this a female characteristic? For example, giving compliments. I think any of us that are females would agree that the art of giving a compliment is probably the most crucial step into being social and communication. It's how we mostly introduce ourselves. If you watch a group of females in any social setting, they may not come up and shake your hand and say, hi, my name is Lori, what is your name? That may be more of a male characteristic of a social greeting. But what you will see played out in any social setting is a female going up to another female saying, I love your purse. Are those new earrings? Where did you get them? Wow, that top looks great on you. Or have you had your hair done recently? And at school, we hear compliments by girls all the time. You know, nice shoes. Wow, I love those shoes. Where did you get them? And so when I prioritize social skills or communication skills for girls on an IEP, I'm going to look at those social skills that are going to have the most significant impact to that female in the long term. And that example of giving a compliment is just one of those. If you can't give a good compliment, if you're, you know, whether we do that verbally or whether we do that through some kind of voice output device or if we're using text, the key here is that girls introduce themselves different than boys. And so every skill that you're teaching, and even in the classroom, you may be a classroom teacher and you may have 14 children on the spectrum, probably about 12 of them are boys. And so we tend to teach social skills that are important for the boys, but not so important for the girls. And so it's important that as the parents or as professionals, when we sit in those meetings or as we plan for home, what are we teaching our girls? We want to make sure that we're teaching them skills that they use every day. So I always tell when I talk to teachers, whether in a workshop or a conference or through the course that I teach in St. Petersburg, that not all social skills are the same. They are based on the age of the child and the gender of the child. Now, this slide that's been up here is just different ways of teaching social skills. And as depending on what book you pick up, you're going to see there's lots of ways to show through pictures and role play and games that are out there and social stories and all of those things. I do want to point out here rather quickly, though, video modeling, that's a whole other topic and certainly an instructional method that's getting quite a bit of research most recently. But if you've never checked out the website Model Me Kids, I encourage you to do so. It's a great website on social skills curriculum through DVDs, through demonstrating through videos. So if you haven't seen that one, it's an excellent one for both parents and professionals. Now, another social skills curriculum that I do love and I think has some great insight for girls and females on the spectrum would be The Hidden Curriculum by Brenda Smith Miles. You might be familiar with Brenda. She works. She's an international presenter, an author, college professor, has written many, many books, and so you've probably picked up or seen one or two of Brenda's books along the way. But one of her books that I've always loved is called The Hidden Curriculum. And here is Maddie again. This picture is a few years old, but boy, I love this picture because here you have Maddie in the pink, looking great. She's a middle school student at the time, so this is maybe 3 years ago. And here is Maddie's, one of Maddie's really good friends, Bailey, is in the yellow. And what I love about this picture is both of these girls are at middle school. So I think they're about 15 months apart, but boy, does 15 months make a difference at that age. So you can see a lot of discrepancies here. But the hidden curriculum, let's go back to that. It is a social skills curriculum, but it's looking at things that we don't think about in our everyday lives as socially significant. Just little things, things like which way do you stand when you walk into an elevator? Do you face the back of the elevator or do you face the doors? Well, somehow, most of us learn just through osmosis that you face the door when you're in an elevator. But that's a hidden rule, though. Nobody really stated that. And so some of our kids on the spectrum, like Maddie, might walk in, face the back wall, or face other strangers in there. Certainly, you face forward and keep your eyes on the door. But it's just those little hidden rules in our day-to-day lives that we forget about. And it's so important that we teach these hidden rules to our girls. Well, Maddie learned this the hard way, these unwritten rules in our classroom. And what happened was when Maddie went to middle school a few years ago, Maddie was doing very well. Danielle prepared Maddie. They did a lot of transition activities, visiting the school, had a really good receptive team of teachers. So things seemed to be going well until one day Danielle gets a phone call from one of the teachers and says, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Wendell, we have a problem with Maddie at school." Of course, Danielle was very concerned about getting that phone call, as most parents might be, until the teacher said, "Maddie is passing notes in class." And Danielle, of course, is doing the happy dance on the other side of the phone because every sixth grade girl, right, passes notes. That's a socially significant behavior. But unfortunately, Maddie did not understand the unwritten rules for passing notes in class. So Maddie would take her piece of paper and fold it up. She did see that. She folded it up, except while the teacher was standing within earshot, Maddie was screaming to a friend or a student across the room, "Hey, hey, here's my note." And Maddie would throw it across the classroom. I think you can imagine that Maddie is observing other kids pass notes, but what are the rules for note passing? Maddie did not pick up on the nuances, right? And I think if we all listed, if you could just take a second and think, what are the rules for note passing? I never thought about that. It's an unwritten rule. Well, first of all, the teacher has to be far away, right? The teacher has to be outside the classroom. The teacher, if she's in the classroom, she's certainly not facing you. She's not within earshot. Another rule is you're silent. You don't say anything when you pass a note, right? You don't throw a note. You put it under your hand and you slide it across the table, right? So these unwritten rules that Brenda refers to, our kids, unfortunately, on the spectrum, our girls, they fall into those potholes because they don't have those rules the same as some of the typical developing kids do. So now what do we do now with Maddie? She's passing notes. She's disrupting the class. The teacher is, you know, feeling like she's losing control. And so does Danielle, as a good parent, say, "Oh, well, I'll tell her to stop doing that." Well, of course not, right? If Maddie's capable, we want her to be able to do that, but in a functional and adaptive way. So Danielle, being a proactive parent, she made sure to practice role-playing with Maddie, how do you pass a note in class. And so Danielle said, you know, she always has to bring in friends and the brother and her husband, and they have to practice these skills. And we all need to be doing that, these hidden rules for our girls. You know, if we're going to teach them how to give a compliment, we need to practice with them in a variety of settings, and same with note passing. So I want you to think about or check out Brenda's work, because I think so much of what we teach our kids is really a hidden curriculum that is not often spoken out loud. Bullying is a hot topic. It's really a topic in and of itself, but I want to bring up just the one thing I'll give you a couple of ideas on bullying. Won't get into a long discussion of the research on bullying, but just know that bullying against girls is very different than bullying within boys. Again, boys are different from girls. Boys and girls bully each other differently, and girls, they are still prone to bullying each other, except it's in a much more subtle way. And so Maddie has had a lot of instances where she's been bullied, but a lot of it she did not realize at first, that girls were being backhanded. They were excluding her. You can't sit with us. Don't walk with us. So girls, we know girls on the spectrum are being bullied. I love Rebecca Heinrich's book, Perfect Targets, because certainly kids on the spectrum can be perfect targets for bullying. Carol Gray, she's the author of Social Stories, also talks about bullying. But I just want to be on the alert that educators, particularly parents, I think we have a better understanding, but educators, if we don't see bullying, we say it doesn't exist. And that is just not the case. Bullying exists, particularly with girls, but it's very subtle. It's very backhanded. The verbal insults, the gossip, even teachers can bully in a way that if they are constantly in the classroom pointing out to the girl, you're daydreaming, you're being lazy, look at me, that constant, what we might think of as redirect as an educator, can come across being a bully to a child. So we have to be very careful about how we say what we say to our kids, and then really watch for the subtle bullying that goes on with girls, because it can be just as damaging as it is with boy bullying, which tends to be more aggressive, more loud, more externalized than what we see with girls. And, of course, Rosemarie's school was hell wrapped in a hot winter fur. And so even Temple Grandin talks about high school being pure hell. And so we know from girls out there that girls on the spectrum, that bullying is something that they are having to come up against every day in school and in the community. So for our girls, we definitely want to work on how do we react to bullying. Many programs out there that you can look at, for example, like Carol Gray's. But one of them, now this is not specific to autism or Asperger syndrome, but the American Girls series. I can't say enough about it. It's almost written for girls on the spectrum. There's visual support. I know you think of the American Girl series as the historical Josephine and Kristen and those characters and those series. Well, the American Girl, go to their website. They have great books on My Body, which I was going to mention under the puberty section, on being friends, on getting along with people. And all of them have great visuals, and they're very concrete and concise. And so if you haven't checked them out, they have great social skills for our girls on the spectrum. So the American Girl series, a lot to offer our girls on the spectrum. Don't forget bullying in terms of sexual harassment. When I see statistics, 83% of girls with developmental disabilities saying that they have been sexually harassed in some way. Boy, we are dropping the ball on this. So I'm just giving you some of the statistics. And here is a great website on bullying and sexual harassment, as well as that cyberbullying. You know, now that everything is on the cell phones and computers with MySpace and Facebook and texting, we as the adults need to be at the head of the curve on all of this. And I love the website cyberbullying.us, where they are educating adults on what does bullying look like in the cyber world. So hopefully you can find some information that might be helpful to you, whether you're a parent or a professional. Next topic that we're going to move on to, we did a little social skills training there, talking a little bit about bullying, but I want to touch on, we mentioned the American Girl series, but a little bit on puberty, and then finish up with some self-advocacy. Of course, you can't talk about girls without talking about puberty and Zosia in her wonderful book, Zosia Zaks, A Woman on the Spectrum, says we're judged differently, right? If a man walks into a social event and his shirt's not ironed and his hair is tussled and he may have a little dirt under his fingers, we all just, you know, chide him on the shoulder, give him a little tap. Hey, how's it going? Looking great. You're a rugged guy. And but boy, you be a female and you walk in and not kept up and didn't brush your hair and dirt under your fingernails, we're judged in a completely different way. And to say that that does not happen is not helpful for our girls. And so I think it's something as the adults, we have to teach our girls that there is a certain amount of respect that comes with taking care of yourself. Temple Grandin talks about that as well. So this is a theme that girls, we have a higher standard. And I don't know that in our Western culture, we're going to be able to change that. And so we need to teach our girls. What do we do? Basic hygiene rules. What is dirty versus what is clean? And Mary Robel has a great book out on that, on those kinds of topics. Mary Robel is written a book on life skills and health and hygiene. I don't know if I have her name written for you, so let me spell it out for you because it's well worth your time. Robel is W-R-O-B-E-L, but Mary Robel has some great information for parents and educators on how do I teach girls from a young age. And does it matter whatever their cognitive skills are? We need to teach our girls what is dirty, what is clean, and what is healthy. What do they need to do to stay healthy? We've got to keep it simple. We don't want to complicate the information. We don't need to go into a lot of detail. I just like to do a little hygiene checklist for our kids so that they can know every day, what do I need to do? And then use teachable moments throughout the day. This is dirty. This is clean. A shirt, clothing, hands, face, hair. Think about all those routines at home as well as at school. And so a checklist may be as simple as what we see here. What do I do when I go into the bathroom? Shower. Shampoo. Now, Danielle always says Maddie was very good at shampooing. She could do it. But she had difficulty getting all the shampoo out of her hair. So they had to put some timers. How long do you let the water run? And they bought some water-resistant timers and put them in the shower because Maddie was getting out, still had shampoo in her hair, and, of course, that creates problems. And so you may need to use specific timers. Use shampoo, but for how long? Brush your teeth. We have to set the timers. What does clean mean? What does dirty mean? And checklists like this, we could use visuals that go along with it, so it might be more of a visual schedule, but we need to start this early on for our girls. Also, thinking about the social stories from Carol Gray, something like a menstruation story. Mary Robel talks about this in her book as well. What is going to happen? The American Girl books, they have great books on how do you know when you're going to get your period, and they can give you some timelines based on growth and development. So as parents, it shouldn't come to a surprise. I had an administrator at one of my workshops recently, and he has a daughter on the spectrum who's 10, and he said she started her period, and he's an administrator, he's an educator, his daughter's on the spectrum, and he said, my wife and I had prepared nothing. We did not know. We didn't know what the signs were to look for. Well, this is where we need to start early. Our kids take a lot of repetition to learn a new skill. And if we want them to be able to, our girls be able to handle those changes, hair is going to be itchy, wearing pads might be uncomfortable. And so there's going to be a lot of practice days for that. So something like a menstruation story with pictures along to go with it, we want to start at least a year ahead of time, 12 months. Look at the American Girl series. They actually have a guidelines of how do you know when your period is coming, underarm hair, your breasts develop, and then within 6 to 8 months, things start to happen as far as discharge. And so we've got to be clear and concrete for our girls so that they have an easier road when the big day comes. I have to tell you with Maddie that Danielle used the terminology, we're going to start your period. You're going to start your period. And everything was the word start, right? And Danielle and Maddie, they practiced and they bought different kinds of hygiene items. And so they were well prepared for the big event. But what Danielle forgot to say to Maddie is that when you get your period, it's not just a one-time event in the morning and then it's over. It's continuous for 5, maybe 7 days. And so Maddie just kept hearing the word, start your period. Pretty soon you're going to start your period. But Maddie was not prepared for, well, when is it over and how continuous is that? So our terminology has to be pretty exacting and concise because, remember, our girls, the abstract does not always come naturally to them. Another quote from a research article out there on girls, we know that if we can empower, and let me transition here on advocacy as we start to wrap up a few of our last items of our discussion. We know that girls on the spectrum, girls with any disability, if we can empower them early, they have higher rates of employment, earning a higher wage after graduation, but more importantly, quality of life. I mean, maybe your child may not be employed outside the home, but that doesn't mean they don't have a quality of life for going out into the community and being part of that community. So I think this is such an important thing to remember, that those advocacy and self-determination skills. Now, first thing, before we get into how do we tell our girls and how much do we tell, I love this website for people with disabilities on who do you tell that you have a disability, particularly our girls, our children on the spectrum as they get older, tend to, you know, do I tell my peers? Do I tell teachers? Do I tell my employer? You don't tell everybody. And I think it's important that we have that discussion. When do I tell? Who do I tell? And how much do I tell that I have a disability? And so this is a great free website for parents. Share this with any family that has a child with disability on the 411 of disability disclosure. I want to quote Leanne Holiday Willie here for a minute. I don't have her exact quote, but she does talk about that sometimes she wishes she didn't tell certain people because, you know, sometimes there are people that don't need to know, and when they do, judgments are made. And so it's important that we educate. Who do we tell? When do we tell, and how much do we tell? So check out that website for some free information. But self-advocacy, self-determination, that means building up our strengths of our girls. This is a key take-home message, and Danielle has done such a phenomenal job with Maddie in that she started very young educating Maddie on what is Asperger's from What Does It Mean to Me, which is a great book out there, actually, by Catherine Faraday, Asperger Syndrome, What Does It Mean to Me? Those early years, getting other books from other females on the spectrum, like Zosia Zak, having that information available at the level of that child is ready for, of course. It's going to be age-appropriate material, age-appropriate information, but our kids on the spectrum, if you talk to anybody from Temple Grandin to Leanne Holiday, really will say, you know, they knew they were different. Let's make this something that is worth talking about in terms that are understandable to our girls and focusing on the strengths, getting them involved in the community. I mean, what is available early on for our kids in the community that they can get involved with, peer mentoring programs, in terms of recreation activities. Maddie, early on, she really was involved in acting, and so she took acting classes from a little parks and rec department, going through your church for activities. But the more we build on their strengths, then we know that, again, going back to that quote, they're going to have a better quality of life, higher employment, more independent skills. And let me refer to Ashley. Wow, is she amazing. Here's a woman, Ashley, who has Asperger syndrome, who we interviewed. For Ashley, she went through a very small private high school, went to community college, and it wasn't until much later that she was diagnosed. Again, she always knew that something was different about her, but unfortunately, the diagnosis was never made after she graduated from college and realized she had a lot of differences with her colleagues when she was trying to get jobs in the community and relationships. And so she was not diagnosed until more recently. Unfortunately for her, she's having a difficult time with the diagnosis, how to tell people, how to incorporate that into her everyday lives. It's really jarred her. As a matter of fact, she said she doesn't even tell family members. So here we have a woman who is well-educated, so many strengths, but because she was not early identified, has not really embraced or seen the gifts that her disability may be able to bring to her and her life. So Ashley is still dealing with that, and her family is still trying to help her look at ways where she can build on her strengths. Of course, she has many, as all our girls on the spectrum do. So maintaining high expectations, let me conclude here by saying that Danielle says when she remembers very distinctly that diagnosis being given of Asperger syndrome, she remembers the depression setting in, the what am I going to do, the denial, Maddie pulling her hair out, having these raging tantrums with another young child in the house. She said, but one of the things her husband and her decided early on, they were going to just maintain as much as they could high expectations. They were not going to say, Maddie can't do that. She can't go to the birthday party, or we're not going to travel. They were going to figure out a way. And she said, it's taken 11 years. Maddie is now 16. I'm proud to announce. I'm also very proud that because of the work that Danielle and her husband Myron have done early on and have maintained about raising the bar for Maddie. As soon as Maddie achieved one thing, it was time to move on to the next goal for her, as all parents do. Having Asperger syndrome has not been an excuse for this family. And now Maddie is at a point where she actually travels with Danielle and I and presents all across the country. So I was very fortunate to be in Texas two months ago, with Danielle and Maddie. We were talking about girls. And then on top of that, here Maddie could say, this is what worked for me. You know, these are my strategies, my solutions, her real life experiences. But she said, even though she didn't like folding clothes when she was six, she didn't like it. And she might have a tantrum and she may, fight against her parents. She was going to fold her clothes, even if it wasn't done the best. Because Danielle and Myron, as parents, we have to maintain those high expectations, and as professionals in classrooms as well, always seeking knowledge. That's why I enjoy doing these types of seminars, coming out and working with school districts, traveling around the world, because knowledge is power. And the more the adults, educators, and parents can be knowledgeable, then we can continue to teach our kids on the spectrum planning for the future. Well, I always say, no matter what age your child is, add 10 years, and that's the plan. We're always planning because it might take 10 years to get to where you want to be. So right now, the plan is for Maddie to drive. Well, as I can tell you, at 16, Danielle has experimented with just a little bit of practice on a golf cart, and that hasn't gone well. There's a lot of things you have to do when you drive, but the plan is 10 years from now, Maddie will be able to drive a car. She may not at 16, but if they start with a golf cart now and they have a quad, a little recreation vehicle that she drives out in the field, it's the steps now that might someday get her to be able to drive for independence. embracing their uniqueness. I think that's been a theme throughout today. Girls are different from boys. We have to embrace the girls in terms of their differences. And then creating a network of support, not only for you, whether you're the parent, whether you're the professional, or whether you're the individual on the spectrum. 10 years ago when I started my own company, there weren't a lot of websites for parents, like Moms Fighting Autism. There weren't classes out there that you could take online, like to St. Petersburg College. And there weren't organizations like GRASP, which is for specifically for kids or for adults with autism and Asperger syndrome. But now, luckily, 10 years have gone by, and the field has grown so much. And I'm so pleased that now people on the spectrum can get together, can network. And I always come back to Autism Society of America, because here's an all-inclusive site, organization that whether you're a parent, whether you're a professional, or whether you're a person on the spectrum, you can network with your colleagues and other adults out there. Well, as I said earlier, from the very beginning, we're going to start from the very beginning, which is Amanda Lemunyan. Hopefully you recognize that painting. That is the cover of our book, Girls Under the Umbrella of Autism Spectrum Disorders. And here we have Amanda Lemunyan. Wow, what an incredible woman. Well, she is a woman now. This is a few years ago. She's 16 or 17 now, so early young adult. But Amanda came to us when we were investigating our book on girls, and Amanda's mom said, after Amanda heard about our book, the mom said, listen, Amanda wanted to paint you a picture. And Danielle and I received by an attachment on our email this picture of Amanda holding this incredible painting. And we had this great aha moment that we had to incorporate Amanda's work. She's an amazing artist. She has won the Autism Society of America's award for an individual with autism. She has won the ICANN Award through Council for Exceptional Children for her artwork. She has had her artwork displayed at the United Nations for World Autism Awareness Day at the Ronald Reagan Museum. So she's an incredible artist. And then secondary to that, Amanda has Asperger syndrome. And so our book, I think, really embraces the uniqueness of girls on the spectrum, women on the spectrum, from the cover with Amanda Lemunyan. Go to her website. If you just type in Amanda Lemunyan, she loves to sell postcards of her artwork and birthday cards. And I think she even did some holiday cards over the last few years. But Amanda would love to hear from you or other artists out there. She's very much praised in the field for her artwork and her talents. And so, of course, she's also somebody who can speak to being a girl under the umbrella of autism spectrum disorders. And that last slide, as I finish up here, is just my bio. And again, that email address, because I've just given you some information on girls and the identification of girls on the spectrum. But, of course, there are more topics to discuss and more areas that you might have a question about. So feel free to email me at drlori@cox.net. All right. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ernstberger. I really could have used that puberty book when I was growing up, so the American Girl series. So
is A plus.
Yep, I'm A-plus. Telling you, I think it would be useful really for anybody.
It is definitely most. And Mary Robel's book is an excellent resource. Hers is more specific to kids on the autism spectrum, but it very much breaks it down into very succinct topics to incorporate. So,
mm-hmm. Okay, I want to let the callers know that are calling in on their telephones that if you would like to ask a question of Dr. Ernstberger, you can press *2, and that will let me know that you have a question that you'd like to ask. In the meantime, I'll go to the questions that have come in through the website. We have one here from Sherry in Oswego. She asks, in regards to social skills groups, should boys and girls be in separate groups rather than co-ed groups to work on learning social skills?
That is an excellent question. Thank you. I love that because I kind of touched on that, right? Mm-hmm. Boys are different from girls. And I live here in Las Vegas, so we have a very large community. And there are certainly social skills groups that are being done both independently and in schools. And unfortunately, they are male dominated, which is fine, you know, because those groups might be few and far between. They are integrated with both males and females. My concern is if the topics that are being covered are only more male characteristics or male social skills, it's not going to be socially significant to the girl. What we know about the research on social skills is if you don't use that social skill every day, it's not going to generalize. So if I teach you a social skill, whether that social skill is how to say hello or personal space, which is different between males and females. Females can get much closer than males, so that's another distinction. I have to make sure that that student or that child is going to use it. So if she's wondering, well, should I send my child to that social skills group? First of all, some social skills is better than anything because we know as far as the quality of life, those social communication skills are the utmost importance. But I would also talk to whoever's the organizer of that to make sure that we're targeting specific skills that are female-oriented. But remember at home, the child, you know, for Danielle and other families, Amanda's mom, we have to look at those skills that we're using every day at home. On the weekends, a visit to Target is an opportunity to teach a social skill. And so I think it's important that social skills groups, that's great. I think it just reinforces. But there's also the things that we can be doing in those teachable moments. So if it's both an integrated, I would suggest that to make sure that we look at what specific skills are being taught and are those gender specific to females.
Okay. A couple of people have asked this. It never even crossed my mind having a son with autism, but they are concerned about their child's menstrual cycle starting and want to know if there's something that they can give the child that will stop the cycle.
Well, I'm not a pediatrician, nor am I a medical doctor, but this has come up, and I've talked to professionals, and there are some birth control that are out there that do stop your menstrual cycle for periods of time, not completely. And now the safety I cannot speak to, the side effects I cannot speak to, but I think I would start looking at that with my pediatrician earlier rather than later, because like that administrator who showed up for one of my workshops said, they were completely taken by surprise when their 10-year-old girl on the spectrum started her period. They had not prepared anything. So I think, you know, it's not too early, 8 years, 9 years of age. We know across the country girls are starting their period earlier. And so 8 and 9 would not be too early to start talking to the pediatrician, getting the books that are available out there, and start preparing whether you go with a medication or not. That's a very valid question, and I know there might be some solutions through medications and your pediatrician, but I would look at those side effects, but also preparing that 10-year-old, I can keep calling them a child, once you start your menstruation, you're really not a child, but preparing them for those nuts and bolts of going through menstruation.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be a very strong theme here in all of our questions. We do have a question that came in from India. It says, thank you for a wonderful presentation. My question is about assessment/diagnosis. Are there any tests, scales, checklists that you know of that is girl-specific for ASD or Asperger's? She says, in India, girls face a lot of discrimination, marginalization, hence would like to know this to help in early diagnosis and intervention.
Wow. Well, you know, we can say India girls are faced with that marginalization, but we had that great quote from Zosia Zaks, who is a female on the spectrum, saying we're facing the same thing here in the U.S., and so that's just unfortunately something that crosses cultures. There are no autism or Asperger-specific assessment tools or diagnostic tools that have different character or different criteria for males versus females. As I said, the ADD community, the medical community, psychologists in the ADD community have started to propose that there be cutoff scores that are different. And to me, that is the direction that we need to lead here in the U.S. And I think if she's working, whether she's a parent or a professional in the field in India, can at least start having that conversation. You know, some of those cutoff scores are very subjective. It's given on a given day, at that given moment, and there's always a rate, plus or minus, of so many points. And I think we, whether she is the parent or the professional, have to advocate for, let's look at information of, like I said, the parent interview or from other sources. And we cannot rely solely on a cutoff score. And we just have to be the squeaky wheel about that. I mean, I know parents, you already know how to do that and how to advocate. And so I think it's just important that continue, that conversation's not going to happen anytime in the next 12 months. Again, we got to plan 10 years from now, hopefully. I could come back and say, yes, there is a specific girl rating scale. But it's more and more of these types of workshops, the books that are out there that are bringing attention. When you go to more national conferences, you're actually seeing sessions now for girls, that we've gotten the ball rolling, and now we need to come together as an international field and say, okay, let's keep going in this direction. We're getting there by at least bringing this issue to light.
Okay. I had a question from Kalina. Kalina asks, since there are gender differences in verbal ability, are girls with autism more likely to be verbal compared to boys?
That is a great question, and there are no statistical research to support in terms of verbal skills, in terms of communication from your speech and language. So there are no research, but again, let's go back to Ami Klin. Let's say I'm going to study the amount or the level or the, you know, how verbal a child is on the spectrum. If I have 100 kids I'm going to study in my clinic, and only two of them are females or less than 5%, they don't represent enough of the population in my research study to quantify a significant finding. And see, we base our findings based on the number, right? So if I have 95 and they're all males, then I'm only proposing that, okay, this is what males look like. So they become research orphans. So it's a catch-22. We want to study the differences. It's hard to find a large group of females. You know, you would have to be in a very large clinical setting to get 100 females that would be studied to see, is there a gender difference between verbalization skills. So it's a great question, one that I think we need to all keep asking at conferences and workshops until we're being heard from places that are doing some of the research out there. Go to your local ASA chapters, Autism Speaks, because right now there is no statistical research to say that there is a difference.
Okay. Maricela from La Habra asks, are there any medical issues that are unique to females on the spectrum that you know of?
Not that I know of. There was some discussion, and I believe it's the Gilbert study, but I can't quote that offhand. And when I think of medical, I'm also thinking anxiety disorders. Now, she's thinking medical, you know, more epilepsy or other medical. I'm not sure what other areas she might be thinking, like a congenital or physical, none of those. The only thing that's ever been brought up in one of the studies that we researched was an increased rate of anxiety in females on the spectrum versus males. That, I think, is not very surprising when we think of the level of anxiety that we see across the spectrum for kids you know, they tend to be an anxious crowd. And females, that's the only one that there was more of a dual diagnosis with an anxiety disorder. But other medical issues, nothing, again, that has been published in any of the clinical research journals.
Okay. Tammy from Punxsutawney asks, my daughter is 12 and going through puberty, and she is having a lot of behavioral issues. Do you think this is from the puberty? I know you said that typically behavior and aggressiveness come from the male side.
But this is more anecdotal. I mean, we interviewed for the book, you know, many families, like Rosemary that brings to mind. And, of course, since the book has come out and Danielle and I and Maddie, now Madison, have spoke all over the country on this topic, we've talked to families who have said very much the same thing, that puberty hit and a more docile child, where Rosemary was more quiet, drawing when she was young, it wasn't until she hit puberty that she became more aggressive, more outbursts, the tantrums. And I think that those hormonal changes, the mood swings that we see with any typical child, can be exasperated because that girl on the spectrum oftentimes has not been taught the coping skills of how to deal with everyday stress that we all deal with. And so unless we're teaching some really good stress management, anything that changed in the schedule, the mood swing, something happened at school, maybe she was bullied, the bus ride home, is going to end up being a much more crisis than what we might see. So I think there's things we can do preventatively to just talk about stress management, again, early on. Everything is that early intervention. That's why it's so important that we diagnose and provide services early so that we can talk about stress management. We all have stress. What does it look like? You know, Jeannie McAfee, her book Navigating the Social World, talks about the stress thermometer to make it very visual and concrete. And so that way when we get to the 10, 11, 12, 13-year-olds, we've already been working on stress management. What do you do when you're stressed? And if I haven't worked on that early enough, Tammy now has a child who did not have coping skills early at 8 or 9. Now add the hormone change to it, you see much more of that crisis, that externalizing of the behaviors. And so I think there are things, it's not too late, of course. I think it's important that parents, no matter where you are in the process, we assess where my child is. What can I do today to provide them more of a quality of life? Well, dealing with stress is one of the things all our kids deal with. There's going to be stress every day. When you go to Walmart, it's stressful. How do I deal with going to Walmart, any kind of travel, visiting as parents? So I think it's important that we look at stress management techniques out there, that we're using that early on. So then when we get to the hormonal stages, at least we already have a foundation for talking about some coping skills. I mean, it's not going to work all the time. They're hormonal. We understand that. But if they have no way of self-monitoring and self-regulating, yeah, it's going to be more extreme, most definitely. And so I think she's right on target from many of the families that we talked to and have talked to. But again, educating the child, depending on where they are. I wanted to give you the title of Mary Robo's book, because I do think it's so great for so many of our kids. It's hygiene, puberty. She calls it a personal curriculum for young people with autism. So it's called Taking Care of Myself. So that might be something that might be a good resource as well.
And again, you spell her last name?
Sure. It's W-R-O-B-E-L. It's not girl-specific, although it has a whole chapter on menstruation. How do you know you're going to get your period? And how do I wear pads? And I just happen to have the book here. So from cramps and things that are private versus public and all those things. But it's a great book, W-R-O-B-E-L, Mary Robo, Taking Care of Myself.
I'm definitely going to get that book. Okay, made a note to myself. Erin from Philadelphia asks, thank you so much for advocating for girls with ASD. As a girl with Asperger's, it means a lot to hear the support. What else can I do to advocate for myself?
Well, she, you know, this, that just gives me goosebumps. I'm telling you that I'm having a moment because, you know, a girl like Erin, I don't know how old she is, so whether we're, you know, younger, older, this is her chance to say, what do I like to do? What am I really good at? And when I mentioned about Maddie, she liked to act, you know, when she was younger and she would do little plays and Danielle got her involved. I think those skills is what's allowing her now to be able to be a presenter about Asperger's syndrome, to be able to talk her, you know, tell her story. Now, that's not for everybody. Some people, like Amanda, she doesn't like to get up in public. She's very nervous. When she won her award at the ASA conference, she could hardly walk up to the front. But what is her strength is painting. Everybody has a strength. And so I think for Erin, it may not be something where she's out there advocating for Asperger's syndrome or autism, but she can display her strength in so many other ways. And it doesn't matter the size of your community. There's always ways that we can build that strength in. I mean, April is Autism Awareness Month, so Erin might want to do something for her community that brings attention to autism and Asperger syndrome. So I think it's important that Erin and her team, whether it's parents or whoever her support team is, saying, what am I good at and how can I use that and really you know, use that as a life goal for what do I want to do 5 and 10 years from now. Looking to people like Temple Grandin, of course, she is the pinnacle of following a dream and a passion in her work in the cattle industry. But everybody has a strength, and you don't have to be a great painter or design cattle for the cattle industry or public speaking, but there is a niche. And when you do what you love, when Erin is doing that, I think that's going to then have other people say, wow, here's a person on the spectrum, and they've accomplished so much. So I appreciate her calling in and listening.
I do, too. I think we have time for one last question. And this one comes from Sandy in Eau Claire. Sandy asks, how can I address the safety of dating to someone that is 22 and has no interest and hasn't dated yet?
Yeah. Sometimes we can't wait for the interest, though, right? You know, I think
right.
With our kids, if they waited till they told us, I want to make a friend, you know, it's too late for social skills, right? So we as the adults have to start prioritizing, and at 22, whether she's interested in dating, she's going to be exposed to males and relationships. And so it goes back to that sexual harassment slide that I saw. I don't want Sandy's family to, you know, be in that 82%. And so dating is a slippery slope and for anybody, any female. And I know I have a 19-year-old daughter and worry about her and dating and being safe. And so I'm not going to talk to maybe the child or the 22-year-old, this young adult woman, that it's for dating. I think we talk about safety. I think we say, you know, you're going to make friends. And you're going to be riding the bus or out at the mall or wherever you are in the community. And those are places where we all need to be safe. And I think probably most of our kids can agree, whether verbally or in their own way, they understand safe versus danger. And that's where I would kind of come from. Let's be educated about safety. And what does it look like when I'm safe? And I think that autism risk management, that's a great website for families. I mean, they talk about everything from safety from little ones running out of your house up to safety for dating and, you know, the opposite sex and all of those things. So I think that whole dating issue, we talk about it in the book as well. So there is a chapter on if she goes on a date, how do I prepare her socially for that? What topics do you talk about? How much personal contact is okay? And we really need to script out, keep it very short. I think maybe the fear of what that might be, an hour, is it 2 hours? It should be something structured. You know, bowling versus going out to dinner. Bowling is a structured activity with a clear beginning and clear ending that this 22-year-old might be more comfortable with versus go out to dinner and just we're going to sit around and talk. That kind of is way too open-ended. So I think looking at the activity, and these are things discussed in our book, looking at what activity, what am I going to talk about? What if I'm, one of the things we mention is give your child a word that is a safety word, that if she calls home and says puppy dog, that means she wants you to come and get her or something is not right and she's not comfortable in saying that, you know. So thinking of and planning of all the little things that might happen on a date, I think is really important. And so we might start from the fact that I'm your parent and I need to make sure that you're safe and what is safety versus danger in social relationships and males. Of course, the cyberbullying has to become part of that. But then talk about, what could a date be? A date can be a small amount of time with a very structured activity. We're going to go here, do one thing, and then come home. And maybe that will be less intimidating. You look at dating on TV, and it's, romantic dinners and dancing, and maybe the 22-year-old is saying, that I don't feel comfortable with any of that. And then on top of that, the 22-year-old needs to be going to their own support groups, networking with like the GRASP organization, which is run by and for people on the spectrum. And so because the mom can say advice, I can give advice, but it's always better when it comes from another 22-year-old woman who is going through the same thing. We can all relate to that. So when you go to the GRASP website, you can hear and see and talk to people for yourself about the whole dating world and so forth. So I would encourage mom to try to educate as much as she can and come at it from different angles and make it safe. But then I would also want the 22-year-old to be able to find a way to network and a group that might be able to help her out as well.
And I think also it would help to watch The Big Bang Theory.
I love that. It's on tonight. No, that won't be. That's not your day. I don't know what day it's on. But, yes, I use that in my workshops all the time because it is classic for learning about dating and how to make a friend and so forth.
Absolutely.
And the other movie that I didn't mention, but while we're talking about entertaining while educating at the same time, is the movie Mean Girls for bullying. If a parent is dealing with bullying, and this would be for boys and girls, although the target for the Mean Girls, of course, is girl bullying, because it really shows how girls bully in such subtle ways and are isolating and demeaning. But it's almost like a video modeling of girls and bullying. So for my parents and professionals out there, use that as an educational tool of what does bullying look like for girls, called Mean Girls.
This has been wonderful, Dr. Ernstberger. I can't thank you enough for joining us and being here to talk about this pretty much, small segment but so important of the, autism population.
And can I just give you my quote from Madison? This is not me saying it, but she loves to end her workshop.
Absolutely.
Madison's quote, so she'll be so happy that I included this, but she says, and it must come from a movie, that girls rule and boys drool. We'll end it with that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, thank you so much. I did want to mention that this webinar will be replayed this coming weekend at our second annual Autism Conference, April 9th and 10th. So be sure and check it out and get the schedule and plot your course and enjoy. I want to let you know, too, that you can get a copy of this transcript by joining our Spectrum Gold Club. There's information on the website about how to do that. You'll get a copy of the webinar audio and transcript, plus 29 other webinars when you join. And also be sure and tell us what you think. Call 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial. That number again is 877-211-0212. I bid everyone a fond farewell, and thank you for joining us today.